this up. I'm getting a fine modem connection that it hangs verifying username and password.
Getting the same trouble trying to connect to the real server on your server.
Oh yeah, that one's turned off today. So I'll comment that out. It crashed midway through yesterday. Today we're going to have lower traffic. Since we didn't even peak yesterday, I figure.
Yeah, shouldn't be a problem. And we stood at the 60.
Right. Makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yep. Okay, well, the levels look great.
All right, I'm going to... you're going to want to watch it real carefully. We have a worse sound system today than we've ever had in any of these, but
okay.
We'll survive, I guess, somehow.
All righty, well, I'll go get the HTML going.
Very well.
Cool.
All right, bye.
Six, 743, can you transfer? Hello?
No, you don't. It's not at your computer. It's what the main server, wherever it is located, points to. And they're not going to point to you because you're not registered in their
That's all.
All you're changing RM. All you're changing
all
everything. We are. If you need to change where you're pointing, it means you can look at everything. And nobody sees you. Doesn't see your site. You can't turn it on the big list of things. The A server is only going to be working for people who registered through the accepted system, which I am going to do.
I have a shoe store, and I'm selling different shoes. I can't advertise in the National Shoe Journal.
it's different in that the shoot port is not the magazine of the internet. But it's not just you can't advertise in the National Journal. You can only advertise in the local paper, and only people who read the local paper, which nobody gets. Local Times. Right, it's a secret that nobody sees.
Well, I have an open on it.
But if it's in a place that's not like that, then
actually is.
Democrats have hijacked the thing and started turning out the Democrats.
Sure, spread out if you like.
Yeah.
Well, the microphone might be helpful because we have some people tuning in on the web, some press, I think. Ben can let us know. She had a long scheduled clerkship. Nothing to see here.
I had another stop lined up before I actually did it. It was on the web. I
don't care.
Oh, actually.
What's her name?
So why don't we get started? Good morning. My name is Jonathan Zittrin. I'm Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, not the Beckman Center, as it says on the screen downstairs if you look. I didn't know who to talk to about the typo, though. And it's actually so common a mistake, we're thinking of renaming the center to catch up with reality. For Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, where I teach a couple courses on internet-related issues. If we have one thing we're studying across different subdomains, it's openness of all things. For that matter, you can see the websites for the courses. They're completely open. Anybody can tune in off of our main website. I thought it might be useful if we would actually just go around and introduce ourselves. Before we do that, I wanted to just say what we were thinking doing this. We've been involved in lots of different issues. We study them, and we also participate in them. And as you know, EFF does the same, and Sherry Steele, who's here, can speak to EFF's role, and Tara LeMay, who just arrived in timely fashion, president of EFF, can speak to that as well. But we thought it would be useful to have a chance to sit around a table in informal fashion. Tara put it a wonderful way when we were talking about it. So often, the players are at the table, and the press is huddled in the corner covering it. Wouldn't it be nice if the press were at the table, and players, such as they are, were kind of receded, and there was a chance to really try to work through some of the issues behind, you know, the headlines that are getting generated as the faucet drips one drip at a time. So that was the idea. This meeting actually is not a closed meeting. Anybody is welcome to attend. Those of you who registered are rewarded by having name tags. Those who don't have to fill in their own. And I think we're webcasting it to several people who couldn't be here, and it was probably our mistake, but those on the West Coast are not happy that we have it at 9:30 in the morning.
But they're not happy, they're not awake.
They're not awake, yeah. But when they wake up, they won't be happy. We prepared a little briefing book, and it's mercifully narrow. And it actually, it's not just Xeroxes of stuff. We actually tried to extract from the piles of documents some useful things, such as, you know, 5 points on ICANN's obligations under the DOC ICANN MOU and the 4 principles of the white paper, things like that that are just sort of landmarks amidst the hills and valleys of all this stuff. And then in the early part, we've tried to do as objectively as possible executive summaries of a lot of the different milestone documents that make up the increasing legalistic patchwork of domain name and addressing issues. There's also some extra copies floating around of the testimony I gave yesterday. That was my first testimony at the hearing, and I'm now convinced that they're just opportunities for the logging industry to benefit, given the amount of paperwork that they generate. So we did our part for that as well. Also in this book is a frequently asked questions document, and they are fairly frequently asked, about the Berkman Center's relationship to ICANN. It is manifold. There are different connections. We want it to be disclosed and upfront. We're not out to lobby for them, but we are connected to them. And part of what we do, which is webcast their meetings and try to create new forms of remote participation where people can be entering questions no matter where they are, and it can be potentially the stone in the stream that changes the direction of the physical meeting as it unfolds. We're aware that that is in itself a form of support to ICANN. It makes them look good. It is helping the organization. We're working with them to see how it can be done best. And in that sense, we are definitely supporting them. But we do so for our own research reasons and because, I guess as I put it in the text, but luckily didn't actually say yesterday, it's something of a barn raising that the white paper calls for, and that we have tried to lift our share of planks in. So with that, maybe I should see if there's anything Tara wants to say, and then we really want to keep any kind of prepared remarks to a minimum. We'll identify the people that we asked to be here within the kind of Berkman EFF archipelago who may be able to provide some good information, and then just open it up to discussion. But I've also got an introduction I can give kind of on the history of the domain name system that
you
may be useful.
It, it's really fun.
And it's relatively brief.
The EFF perspective on why we wanted to do this and, you know, become part of a sort of ongoing series and dialogue with the media is we get calls constantly from y'all on background questions on things like ICANN and digital music and, you know, identity space and all kinds of other stuff. And we never, you know, have the time during those periods to really get into any of the discussions about the implications that we're concerned about or why are we involved in the issue and where does it come from. So instead of sort of, you know, having the media sort of locked away somewhere, talking to us in like 3-minute snippets to try to understand the issues, we figured here we can all engage and actively try to get together to bring out some of the stuff and understand it better. And then understand where things look like from all, you know, other parts of the table.
We also wanted to give you an angle that's a little bit more human. One of the biggest problems that we hear from the press, the questions that they ask is, how do we write this story in a way that someone's going to want to read it? And so we're hoping that maybe we can give you some ideas of things that are, you know, interesting ways of writing.
Yeah, and unlike Berkman, we have no relationship to ICANN.
Now, wait a minute. Miss May, isn't it true that Esther Dyson was... Anyway,
wait, but yes, you can ask that question. Esther's actually been recused from any EFF board involvement at all.
Esther Dyson is the chairman of ICANN and is on our board of directors, has been our former chairman of the board, is very active with EFF, and she really does recuse herself from all domain name / ICANN conversations. So within EFF, obviously not within ICANN.
So it's so we're actually almost, we're down a player, as it were, because we don't actually get her to contribute in the discussion, so it actually puts us almost in a weird disadvantage in some ways. But we're trying to, the issues that we have are, it doesn't matter what the mechanism is for getting to the solution with domain names and with addressing. The civil liberties issues are going to be there regardless of what the execution end of it is. And so I think that that's, for us, a fairly important notice.
Great. So with that, why don't we just, I'd love to just go around and have us each introduce ourselves, who we're with, if anyone, and anything you think might be of interest, if you've covered this before. Just something interesting about how you connect to this. Let me start.
I'm Dave McGuire. I'm from NewsBytes, and I don't think I have anything interesting to say at this time.
I'm Heather Phillips.
I've written maybe one story on the issue. Interesting background. Catherine Emily. I'm a research associate at Berkman Center.
I'm Tamar
Frankel.
I'm a
professor
of law at Boston University Law School.
I'm related to the no longer involved directly in ICANN. There's more than observer, but I chair the what's called the International Forum of on the White Paper last year, and cannot really and do not wish to expertise myself in what I consider to be a very important
I'm a private practice in Boston, and I was appointed to ICANN membership of the advisory committee, the first committee that was set up. The purpose of the committee was to design the at-large membership structure and election process so that the half of the board that is democratically elected segment can be put in place as quickly as possible.
I'm Alice Schaefer-Van-Helling. I'm a former staff member of ICANN and a former fellow at the Berkeley Center, so it is Berkeley Center, now clerking in Boston.
I'm Terry Wesser. I work for Federal Planning for Downtown Central Park.
Terry Foster, New York, telling me how long.
Marilyn Berger with the National Journal of Technology.
Mike Barker with Web Hosting Magazine.
Carl Kaplan, I write a law column for the website of the Times.
Juliana Grunwald with National Journal of Technology Daily.
Christina Bilski, Nikon News.
Hi, Alexander, RTC Spectrum, and Rich Warner, Russian Federation, and Eastern Europe.
Carolyn Marston, I'm a reporter with Network World.
I already did mine.
I'm Sherry Steele, Director of Legal Services at Electronic Frontier Foundation.
I'm Bennett Holman, a student at Harvard and affiliate at the Berkeley Center, and also broadcasting at
Annual. I'm Andrew Shapiro, here representing the Marble Foundation.
And there's some people along the back.
I'm Pat Zibidor, reporter with Julia Long at
the Marble Foundation. Mary Long,
here on Twitter with Texas. Kathy Meyer,
National
Journal. Brian Heist, Davis
International. So is there any, I hate you guys to kind of be marginalized. Feel free to unmarginalize yourselves if you want. okay, and each of the people who's here to, I hate to use the word brief, I think of briefings then. This is not a briefing. But those here, of the people who are here to help brief, have a couple areas that they're able to kind of be somewhat expert on and speak to. And I thought it might be useful just to give kind of my quick overview as I would do it in a session of my Internet and Society class for how this came about. And before I do that, I just wanted to point out there are basically two areas that are of special interest to me. The first is the way in which we all know that technology can be politics, exactly how to translate when it is so that those who would care about the politics, if only they weren't bored or confused by the technology, is a real challenge. The domain name system, I think, is a great case study of that. It carries with it its own political issues, but even beyond those, I do believe it's the first step in a series of steps where we'll be seeing whole swaths of particularly Internet issues coming up just the way that DNS has. As my brief story that I'm about to tell will hopefully point out, the ways in which the Internet developed are just so bizarre, and they are this weird hybrid between public and private. They're public in that they're open standards. Nobody owns it. Anybody can code to TCP/IP standard and not have to give a license, or get a license from someone, or pay a dime to do it, as every email that they enable sails across the network. It's a very different model from, say, operating systems, where the most popular operating systems are proprietary. They're developed by companies who think about what would be smart to develop next. They do it, we buy it, we use it, and it's a closed system. And one can even imagine just the opposite having developed. An open, say, Linux system, operating system, hooking each computer together on a closed network. We could all be running Novell as the Internet, and Novell would be making out like a bandit. Or it could be everybody just on AOL. I mean, there was a time when it looked like the entire Internet just might be, we're all at AOL.com. And that's how the messages go back and forth. Yeah. Interesting.
That's him wearing his CompuServe sys on.
Yes, well, we only recently got bought by AOL. In any case, the interesting way in which the Internet has developed is an open system, and one that has been an open and heretofore quiet backwater is changing. Please come on in if this is where you think you belong. DNS is a great case study of that. And secondly, just given that it's what we're so interested in, the question of openness. ICANN, because it's taking over these hybrid functions, is at once private. It's a private company. It has a board instead of a governance structure. And at the same time, because it's public, and yet because it bears on all of us, because it has the market power of the Internet, TCP/IP Internet, the one that, you know, you talk about multiple routes or alternative Internets, they're hard to come by. There's this desire for ICANN to have the qualities of government that entail openness, public participation, due process, deliberation, and ICANN has been trying to kind of invent it from first principles, and that leads to a lot of problems. So that's another area that is definitely worth talking about. So all that said, I just want to give a quick background as to how we see it as it came about. It used to be that computers weren't hooked together, and then somebody got the idea of hooking them together. And when you hook together one computer simply to another, it was not hard to identify who was whom, because you were you and it was it, and since you knew who you dialed or where you ran your cable, that was the other computer. Once somebody came up with a brilliant idea of packet switching and hooking every computer to every other computer, but still wanting to route information from one simply to another, rather than to all of them that happened to be listening, you had to find a way to identify each different computer. And as you may or may not know, that was the beginnings of IP protocol. IP numbers were just a way of giving a serial number to each computer. As you hook a new computer onto the big network, give it its own number, and then you could address things meant for it with that number, throw it into the stream of bits that is nearby you, your subnet. That stream magically gets onto the bigger stream and wends its way towards the computer that has the corresponding number. Now, for this to work, each computer has to have a unique number, and somebody has to keep the list. It's a chore. It's an incredible chore. If you do it wrong, mistakes happen because computers get the same number, or you run out of numbers, as is happening. You wouldn't think you could run out of numbers since there's an infinite number of numbers. But the way they did it, they're running out. And there's a new IP coming out, IP version 6, which is meant to solve that problem and have enough numbers for the number of stars in the universe. And as we said in a meeting yesterday, the number of toasters that are eager to get online can finally join the networked environment thanks to IP version 6. But it didn't stop there, because the numbers are hard to remember. There are things like 128.36.0.19, and they are too wired directly to a particular location. If you move from one to another, you abandon your old computer and move to a new one, if your computer had a number and you wanted to keep getting your mail, you'd have to take your number with you, and then you would literally get into doo-doo-doo. The number you have reached, 128.36, has been changed to the new number, so that's a problem. So domain names kill two birds with one stone. First, they give you a mnemonic so that you don't have to remember a bunch of numbers, and second, they provide a level of indirection so that I can be getting a number and abandoning it all the time, and for those of you who are stuck on AOL, that's what happens. When you sign on with a dial-up, you're actually assigned just a number for the temporary session, and it's the domain name that may be slightly more static, or at least your name attached to a domain name where nobody has to worry about the underlying numbers. Now, for that to work, you need a table that can take a name in one end and come out with the right number that corresponds to it on the other end. And originally, it was just a big table. There was just a file kept at MIT of every single computer that was recognized on this internet with a name, and then correspondingly every number, IP number, that it mapped to, because you ultimately need the number to get to where you're going. And they just had names like Fred and Bill, and, you know, I'd claim Dave, and then that was it. There were no more Daves. You could see it maybe running like Netscape bookmarks, where people would, you know, my Dave isn't the same as your Dave on your bookmarks file, but then you couldn't just say on your business card, I'm Dave, that's how you reach me. Problem was that did not scale. If it got so big that it would break, it wouldn't be very useful, and that's exactly what happened. The poor guy at MIT keeping the list found that it was getting longer and longer by the second, and people were also hitting the MIT computer to get the updated list all the time as the exponential knee of the curve was hit. So they came up with the idea of the modern domain name system, which is a wonderful hierarchy, and this is where you get into the dots. And the idea was that to resolve a domain name, what you would do is ask a root computer, somewhere there'd be something called the root, and you'd say to the root, I'm looking for an edu at the moment. Can you tell me who knows about edus? And they'd say, yeah, there's a designated list keeper that only has to know about .edus, and they're over there, and would point to some place on the internet by IP number. So you'd say, thanks a lot, you'd go to the edu place and say, I'm looking for harvard.edu. Say, harvard.edu, okay, that's on our list. Harvard.edu is over there. And you'd go to some place, perhaps a computer in the custody of Harvard. You'd say, I'm looking for law.harvard.edu, and it would be able to tell you. And the helpful thing about that is, as Harvard adds new computers, they don't have to keep going back to the keeper of the edu list to add their names. They are in custody of harvard.edu and can be adding them there, and not have to be worrying people upstream about changes to their systems. But in the meantime, somebody still has to keep the edu list, and somebody has to keep the root. These were originally chores, just as keeping the IP numbers were chores, so it was whoever kind of drew the short straw. And the people developing all these protocols, coming up with these ideas, affirming that, all right, this sounds good, were largely a bunch of engineers, members of something called the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF. IETF is not incorporated, it has no particular headquarters, it's just a phenomenon. And you can go to IETF meetings, you go there, maybe they'll charge you a small fee just to cover the donuts at the meeting, but there's no cost to it to join the IETF. And when you go, what I guess keeps it on engineering and not on other topics is you just don't understand a word that's said unless you come prepared to talk about engineering. And there'll be long arguments on engineering subjects, heated perhaps. Eventually consensus will be called for, there'll be kind of mumbles, and there's either consensus or there's not, and a new standard can be born. And then when they're not at the meeting, they have mailing lists where there'll be various calls, and you can join the list if you know where to look. Dave Clark once told me that the IETF kept changing its name, actually, so that as people were finding it, they would lose it again and have to go to effort to find it again, and thus was born the Internet Engineering Steering Group, the Internet Architecture Board, and a series of other acronym organizations, each leaving the other behind. So a guy named John Postel out in California was among these engineers and took some government money as grants. He was an academic at the Information Sciences Institute at USC. Took government money just to do good work in networking. And part of his good work was to maintain big parts of the domain name and numbering system and to serve as what was called the RFC editor, the guy who was actually the quill holder on the final documents. There became some formality to this, RFCs, that documented these protocols as they emerged from the meetings and the mailing lists. And if you go to IETF.org, you can actually start digging through different RFCs, requests for comments, the final versions of which are not requests for comments at all. They're just the way it is. Of course, when you say this is the way it is, all it means is here's the standard that we've all apparently agreed to, adopt it or not as you like. And it's actually just the power of social pressure among network administrators responsible for maintaining protocols on their respective internet nodes, or among software developers that are coding, say, an email client to be compatible with something like Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. That's developed through the IETF. It's an open protocol, and then you code your email to it, or you don't. And if Eudora doesn't use SMTP, it's not very useful because everybody else is expecting SMTP. So it's kind of a wonderful system of suasion that developed around it. So for a while, John actually ran the root, and he also was the guy that the root pointed to fill in com, net, org, edu, and he was actually the guy that led the process and decided there would be com, net, org, and edu, and that gov would be the United States government, not just all governments, and that mil would be the United States military, not just all militaries. It was formalized only to the extent that you could find it in an RFC. There is an RFC that lays these things out and says this is how it ought to be. And then John would adjust the route accordingly. He's also the guy that came up with country codes, assigning each country a country code, and not wanting to engage in foreign policy, having to decide whether Palestine deserved a country code or whether the lucrative .pa domain, because you could have grand.pa and things like that, would go to Paraguay or Panama or Palestine. So he actually looked for a list and found it with the International Standards Organization. Their list number 3,166 is a list of countries and corresponding two- and three-letter codes for them. And that was the rule then. And if ISO changed 3166, John would change the route. He got bored of maintaining com, net, org, and edu. It became a chore. Told the National Science Foundation, which had funded a lot of this stuff, I don't want to do this anymore. They just put it out for bids. Who wants to maintain this list on a five-year contract? Thus stepped forward Network Solutions, said, we'll do it, and originally was simply paid a fee to maintain the list. And I remember actually being back in college in 1990 and hearing about something called InterNIC and knowing that I could even reserve my own domain name, but the forms to fill out were so frightening. And you had to put on the form the name of a name server, which is to say, if you get dubbed Hertz.com, we need to know where to point to you so you can tell everybody where law.hertz.com is and car.hertz.com. I didn't know how to do that, so I did not reserve hertz.com, much to my chagrin, nor any other names that were widely available. And in fact, the only reason you didn't get a whole pile of them was just because it would annoy the people at InterNIC. You know, do you really need all these names? No, I guess not. I'll just take the first three. It just sort of, again, worked in this kind of suasive way. some names, however, were snapped up, and eventually an amendment was done to the NSF-NSI cooperative agreement by which they were registering names, by which Network Solutions could start charging. And they did. They started charging a fee per year to maintain domain names. That actually raised a big fuss in the internet community at the time, but it happened nonetheless. Two things happened to bring events in the domain name world to a real head, in my view. Thing number one is that the web hit the big time. It became highly commercial. Companies realized they started to need to hang their shingles there and found that the most obvious places to hang their shingles, Hertz rent-a-car at Hertz.com, had already been taken by somebody, either by a speculator, as in the case of Hertz.com, who had simply reserved the name and then turned around to Hertz and said, I knew you'd wake up eventually, now what am I bid? Or it would just be, you know, MCI.com had been taken by Sprint, and Kaplan had been taken by Princeton Review. And in fact, there had been a funny site about how bad Kaplan was, Kaplan.com. Funny to some, disturbing to others. Also, I guess, realized that the reason why the logical place to hang your shingle and why you'd feel really upset if you couldn't at Hertz.com was that Hertz.com was how people were starting to get around. Remember, there was a time that there was an internet but no web. When there's internet but no web, you were basically emailing people or using WAIS. Remember WAIS, the Wide Area Information System, where, yeah, or Gopher, things like that. But it was really the web browser that was the first gateway to the popularization of the internet as we know it. And it's that little window at the top of the browser where you type in a domain name to say, this is where I want to go. Now, of course, it's just the browser coders that decided domain names were what belonged there. And in fact, in the past year, they've wised up. And now if you type in something that doesn't have dots in it, they say, oh, yeah, that's a Netscape keyword. We'll tell you where Hertz is. And they're now providing their own set of names that's completely independent of the domain name system that they simply own as a proprietary thing. And indeed, there are companies beyond Netscape and Microsoft that are starting just databases of names, real names. And if you type in the name, it'll take you to the place. And if real names became wildly popular, you could imagine seeing real names on buses instead of domain names. And then all of the fights that you see over domain names would be shifted over to real names. But the governance may not go with it, because after all, it's not this quasi-public, quasi-private thing. It's clearly a proprietary database started and run by a single proprietary company. So anyway, trademark interests were upset that they had to actually go through legal process to take Hertz.com away, if that was what was going to happen from whoever had it, and that this first-come, first-term system had essentially disadvantaged them because they hadn't wised up soon enough. A second issue was simply the money to be made registering names. Network Solutions went from a sleepy small company that had made that original bid into an enterprise making, at least as of last year, approximately grossing $1 million a day doing the ministerial task of registering these names or re-registering them, simply renewing a name that had already been registered, doing roughly $300,000 a month last year. A number of people wanted a piece of the action doing that. That led to pressure for new top-level domains like .biz or .per. And in fact, some people just said, I'm going to be .per, and I'm going to set up a registry for it. And you can register your name with me, and to be sure, no one will be able to get to, you know, your name .per yet. But when it happens, I'll grandfather all your names in if I'm dubbed the person who can be .per. Of course, for that to happen, somebody would have to make the change to the root file so that if an inquiry comes to it about .per, it doesn't say, I don't know. It says, no, no, here's where .per is. That hasn't happened yet. And for new domain names to happen, it's a good question. Would John just wake up one day and say, I'm going to change the root? It looked like that might be the case. He tried to have a little more formality to it. He convened the Internet Ad Hoc Committee. The Internet Ad Hoc Committee, a number of people selected from among the internet community, met in Geneva, the place where international deals get done. They talked a lot. They came up with the GTLD MOU, the Generic Top-Level Domain Memorandum of Understanding. Anybody could sign it. It's a document that was just open to signatories. It was deposited at the International Telecommunications Union in a subsidiary of the United Nations. I don't know if anybody here is a signatory to the GTLD MOU or further would want to admit it, because as it turns out, the GTLD MOU, which set up a huge structure, a policy oversight committee and a council of registrars. I mean, it's amazing the bullet chart that this thing set up to make decisions like there's going to be a .biz and this is who will run it. And they actually, their opening salvo was, and before this whole apparatus gets cooking, let's just arbitrarily introduce seven new names like .per, .web, .firm, .store, .arts, .nom, blah, blah, blah. So that was what came out in the GTLD MOU. It goes over to the ITU, which happily stewarded it. The ITU, of course, most known for assigning country codes in international phone dialing so that you can have direct dial from any phone in the world, very much in important ways, an analogy to the root system as we know it. And it's the ITU that, you know, assigned number 1 to us, the United States, and number 593 to Ecuador and 44 to the United Kingdom. People would sign the GTLD MOU. At some point, John would say, all right, there's enough signatories, it's time to change the route, and we've got legitimacy and authority to do it, because look at all these people who signed, and organizations. Unfortunately, by that time, unfortunately for John at least, the route was no longer in his physical custody. It wasn't actually running off his computer in his office, as it had been, afraid that perhaps the plug might get kicked out at some point. He'd asked Network Solutions to steward the route. This was not part of their agreement, Network Solutions' agreement with National Science Foundation to do this, but Network Solutions ran the primary A-root server. And indeed, they've made a small tourist concession out of it. If you go to Network Solutions, perhaps some of you have gone on the Network Solutions tour, where they'll take you to a room, an air-conditioned room, full of big computers, and at some point they'll take you over, and this kind of religious silence fills the hall, and you see two really bored-looking Pinkerton guards standing in the corner, because after all, it's the root they're guarding, and they point you to, you know, a PC, and it says a root server on it, and one day, you know, the thing where you can generate little labels out of the squeeze thing, it says a root server, and, you know, I was in this tour group at one point, and it's like, can I touch it? Yes, you can touch the root. And then he said, you know, I'll give you $2,000 for 40 keystrokes on the root keyboard. And he was declined. And of course, the root, it's no secret what's in it, right? It's a file whose purpose is to be accessible for those who wish to use it. It's just that it's everybody pays attention to it. There are 13 roots around the world, 12 of whom mirror the one that is in Network Solutions by their choice. And of course, the people running these root servers do it as volunteers. There's no particular contracts that exist, at least until recently. There may have since been an ICANN root server operator contract that got signed, which in putting together our briefing book, we couldn't find anywhere. But from the rumor we hear, it's just sort of, we all agree to be nice to each other. It doesn't actually impose any legal obligations on either side. But the idea is that these people run the mirrors around the world, and they mirror this root. John was told, as we understand it by Network Solutions, don't even ask. Don't even tell us. Even though when, you know, Zaire becomes Congo and you're the guy that calls and says it's time to make ZR into CD because ISO just changed their list and jazz.cd gets registered in a heartbeat. He said to John, while you call us to make those changes, don't pick up the phone and call us and tell us that it's time to add .nom, .per, .stuff like that, because we won't do it. And thus came the first constitutional crisis of the Internet, where the handshakes on which things had been operating were no longer as binding as they used to be. This is what got John interested in doing a little test by which he asked most of his pals, who were these root server operators around the world, to actually start directing their roots to him rather than to Network Solutions as a test to see how easily the root could be ported in the event of, I don't know, a nuclear crisis or something. 6 of the people did so, and Network Solutions had a cow. And the U.S. government stepped in to say, okay, it's time to somehow get into this brawl and fix it. And thus came what some of you may know as the Green Paper, then to be followed by the White Paper, a policy statement by the Department of Commerce saying, this is how things ought to happen. It's unclear again what binding legal effect that has, but it was a consensual hallucination that we indulge to this day, and that you do get the sense was meant with the best of intentions and with tons of high-level meetings internationally and among government officials. So thus was born the White Paper, which called for a new organization to come forth to take on the functions that John had informally served, running the route, adding new names, and indeed not just adding new names, but helping to oversee the process of competition within the existing names like Com, Net, and Org, so that there wouldn't just be one company responsible for registering. That started a process over the summer that Tamar chaired in called the IFWP, the International Forum on the White Paper. I'll be interested to hear from Tamar today exactly who ran it. I mean, you chaired it, but who asked you to do it? And, you know, I'll ask you in a second. But it's unclear exactly who started. The first meeting was in Reston, Virginia, home to Network Solutions. I don't know if any inferences should be drawn from that. But IFWP met in several international locations around the summer was an extraordinary process in which we participated. People got into a room. The very first meeting, actually, if you asked anybody in the room, you know, oh, so you've come for the IFWP, they'd say, no, no, I'm just here to watch. I'm not here to participate. And in fact, there were zero participants in the first IFWP meeting in Reston and approximately 250 observers. And they all started talking. It's like the first flight of Freedom Air. Remember the airline that was, you know, it was a private club where you could smoke? And the first flight of Freedom Air, and it might have been the last, it was a bunch of reporters and, like, one guy who was, you know, huddled in his seat just trying to have a smoke. Anyway, that was the first IFWP meeting. And there were a number of follow-on meetings when Tamar just had a stroke of brilliance, in my view, where she said, look, our point is just to come to consensus points. What can we all agree on? Because if we don't start with that, we're just going to have a bunch of fights, and that's what we've had heretofore. So IFWP went along and documented consensus. In the meantime, John Postel said, you know, I've been thinking there ought to be a new IANA for a long time anyway, IANA being John's alternate ego, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, not incorporated, no legal personality, can't sign contracts, but it was John. And he said, you know, I've been meaning to incorporate it anyway, make it more formal. I think the NUCO that is called for in the white paper is really just the new IANA, and I'm going to put out some bylaws for it. And people can follow them or not. Hey, you know, I don't have an army, but let me see what I can do. So in a process that mirrors the RFC process in large part, he just said, I'm going to come up with bylaws. People can send me comments. Just email, you know, comments@iana.org, and I'll forget about the bad ones. I'll adopt happily the good ones and put out new iterations, and eventually we'll have our goal. So he sort of industriously did that while IFWP was documenting consensus, and as the September 30 deadline loomed, a deadline in which the original contracts and cooperative agreements, both to IANA from NSF and to Network Solutions from NSF were deigned to expire. John ended up with a set of bylaws. IFWP was not angling towards that. Network Solutions published its own proposed bylaws for a new corporation called the Community Consensus Bylaws. And at one point, actually asked us if we would take them up and start calling them the Harvard Bylaws. Or the Harvard Solutions bylaws, I guess. We declined to do that, but said we would be happy to serve as a forum in which maybe the last parties could get together and talk. Thus was born the idea, actually, of a final wrap-up meeting in which everybody would get together, get in a room, and it would be make or break. We either solve it or we don't. And in particular, the great fault lines between Network Solutions and IANA, who truly don't have a lot of good things to say about each other, to put it mildly. Would get in a room and work it out. And they had heretofore not gotten in a room. They would not even talk to each other. So the wrap-up meeting was proposed. IANA said, you know, we'd rather not. I just don't want to get in a room with these people. So if we think we can cross the finish line without having to have a big wrap-up meeting with a bunch of random people around a table, open this question here. That's no way to do this. I don't want to, unless I really have to. Network Solutions pushed for it until, as I understand it, the government said to both of them, just get in a room with each other and solve it. And with that, they met in Washington quite privately. The two of them just sat there for a week. They finally emerged with a new document called ICANN between both Network Solutions and IANA. At that point, Network Solutions called up and said, you know that wrap-up meeting we were calling for, which all the parties could openly get together? We don't really need that anymore. And thus, the wrap-up meeting was canceled. And of course, IANA was perfectly happy to cancel the wrap-up meeting as well, since they'd never been in favor of it. So the wrap-up meeting was canceled. A number of people that had non-refundable plane tickets to Boston wanting to sit in on this meeting, if not participate, came to Boston anyway because they couldn't cancel their travel. Thus was formed the Boston Working Group, of which Diane was a member. That one can be told. Diane was a member of the Boston Working Group. They got together in the downtown offices of Hale and Dorr and sat down to... And they redlined them. So BWG actually showed up on the doorstep of the Commerce Department before September 30th and said, all right, here's our proposal. And John said, well, here's our proposal, along with a slate of proposed board members, and that had actually been asked for by the white paper. BWG did not want to propose board members because they didn't, I think, feel they had the legitimacy to do that, and said, no, no, we'll have to elect them later. And another group called the ORSC also submitted bylaws. So there was a brief period of time where the Commerce Department put out a carefully worded letter that said, we're really liking the IANA bylaws, but, you know, why don't you try to talk to BWG and ORC and get real consensus among these three parties before we really crown you as NewCo. Also in this period, John passed away. So it was quite a difficult time when the Commerce Department didn't even know who to send their response to, didn't know who to address it to. I think they sent it to the executive director of ISI, who, you know, had no idea necessarily what John had been up to, and immediately forwarded it over to, I think, Joe Sims, who had been John's pro bono lawyer. And later, as ICANN was actually incorporated, the papers were filed, ICANN came into being, was then named ICANN's counsel. So thus was ICANN formed, and I don't know if it's worth it to go into history since then, but essentially there's been the pressures that were before are still there, lots of pressures about competition and domain name registration, lots of pressures about trademark. WIPO came up, the World Intellectual Property Organization, with a set of recommendations that have been explicitly asked to provide by the white paper policy pronouncement. So those recommendations have landed on ICANN's doorstep. ICANN is now digesting them through this Byzantine process of supporting organizations, constituencies, independent review advisory committees, internal reconsideration and review, which is different from independent review advisory committee, and may well come up with something in Santiago. But I feel I've been droning for too long. So that's essentially my take at how we got to where we were, and hopefully fills in why, when questions come up about where does the Commerce Department get the authority to delegate these functions, you just see it now as just a not quite well-formed question. What is it delegating? It didn't used to do this. What it did was take from NSF cooperative agreements to fund research. So it's unclear that it was really the government's to do, but on the other hand, it didn't belong to any private company either. So it's this kind of public-private hybrid that bedevils us to this day, and yet still has provided the most clear path we've seen to maintaining the system the way we like it. But it's definitely, at least my personal sense, that the politics are in it. There's no way to take it out. So just sort of leaving things in the sleepy IETF backwaters does not help, because you will then get the lawyers crashing the IETF meetings. There'll be kind of the matter and antimatter convergence that could cause great harm. And, you know, the IETF, for their part, wants to, as much as possible, focus on the tech and not on the politics. And whether or not you can keep that somewhat artificial separation is a good question. As I was saying in another meeting yesterday, you know, IETF works on things like how to make certain packets go faster and others slower on the Internet, for the perfectly noble engineering purpose of letting video streaming not be herky-jerky while emails may land on your desk 2 seconds later. But of course, the idea that you could end up with a system where there could be slow packets and fast packets, and therefore some pigs could be more or less equal than others, designated by some kind of central authority, has obvious political implications that at some point or another might find yourself working into the architecture. So with that, why don't I wrap up? I don't know if it's worth it to kind of talk about any of that now or turn it over. Is there anything you want to add, Tara?
On that? I think we want to actually talk about sort of some of the implications of what's going on with this. But before we do you guys, does anybody have any questions on sort of the where this thing was birthed from issue?
I have a question on the contractual arrangements, because there's a lot of discussion of what are contracts, what are cooperative agreements. Could you just walk through, you know, what NSI has with NSF, what NSI is supposed to need to sign with ICANN, and what's Commerce's role in there, and what is it that NSI has to sign with Commerce by the end of September of next year?
Right. I could do a good cut at that, but actually, Molly, you may even be in a better position if it's all coming back to you like a nightmare now. Would you rather do it, or do you want me to take a crack at it? Okay. I actually, in preparation for the hearings yesterday, have a briefing book that actually contains most of the contracts that are at stake. Originally, there was this NSF agreement with NSI to do the registrations. It's been amended, I think, 13 or 14 times since then. When people are talking about Amendment 11, they're talking about the 11th Amendment to that agreement.
And it's a cooperative agreement, not a contract? Or can you call it a contract?
A cooperative agreement, to the extent that it says, we're going to give you this and you're going to do that back at us.
It's a contract.
It creates obligations.
It's semantics.
On the other hand, here's an example where it actually comes to roost. You'd ask a simple question, what happens if the contract were simply to expire? Now, here's interpretation one. You, government, came to us and said, we'll give you a pile of money if you do these chores. contract lapses, we no longer give you the pile of money. Can you keep doing the chores? If you're crazy enough to do it, you know, well, who are we? We just asked you to do it, so you keep doing the chores. In this case, the chores have become registrations under ComNet and Org. Network Solutions' position is contract expires. If we want to, for the good of the internet and stability, keep doing these chores, we can keep doing them, and they can't stop us. They were just helping us. Another interpretation, and I actually got into a wonderful argument with Tamar about this, where I was arguing the first view. Tamar was arguing the opposite view that said, come on, it's work for hire. They're actually producing something. They're getting the money for the labor, but the product of the labor, the database, is the property of the U.S. government under the cooperative agreement. Now, what was accused at the hearing yesterday of being bad drafting was just simply, you know, who knew in 1992 that this would be an issue? It's just wonderfully ambiguous. You know, you throw a big lawsuit, and some judge is going to have to scratch her head and look at this thing and say, I don't know, the contract isn't clear who owns the database at the end of it.
But that's the point. It's still a contract. It's just not clear. There are terms of the contract that haven't been spelled out very well.
That's right.
They call it a cooperative agreement, because it seems like throughout this whole process, the word contract isn't used. They use MOUs, they use cooperative agreements, they use all sorts of different things to mean contract.
But the fact that they quit getting paid by the government in 93 helped their case on that.
I don't know, because then you...
Started charging individuals, right?
But then...
Is that complicated then?
It might, but then you'd say back to them, well, I'll tell you what, after you started charging yourself, why wasn't that just the way out of the contract? Why didn't the contract expire then with NSF giving it? And there's even been this idea that may be differently argued legally, but that Network Solutions can't raise its price beyond the price that NSF allowed it to charge. So you get a sense it's a price control, it's still a government service. They're just getting checks written by people rather than taxes to the government and then checks back to NSI.
After all, the whole system was subsidized, was financed by you and I, mean by the taxpayer. And that's one of the arguments, that this system belongs to the United States. That it allows, it outsources, quote, certain activities. We do it all the time.
But what about, didn't they say that, doesn't Amendment 11, or one of the documents say that they only have to turn over a copy of the database? Isn't it?
The whole structure of procurement and terms of collaboration and joint agreements versus contracts are terms of art within that whole process. And in particular, you know, a collaborative agreement, usually there is function going on on the one part of the agreement. A CRADA, which is the newest one, the format they're using, is where the government actually conducts the research, and the rights for that may be shared by the private contractor, which is universal or traditional. Yeah, so they are terms of art, and it just has to do with the duties of each party under, so they issued that they're all contracts. There must have been something done to avoid, either if it wasn't money, it was something else.
Well, Network Solutions often says that cooperative agreements were done billions of times by NSF to promote various kinds of research, and then at the end of the grant period, the research was owned by
Republicans. There's huge amount of statutory regulation. Who gets the rights in default
right.
And who can transfer and how long? And normally, if the government sponsors a research project, the contractor may have the right to develop it to get it to the public, but there are usually this language in that that says if you don't do it by, you know, the day time period, the government can come in and capture it and take it back. But there will be an obligation of the contractor to make that research available to the public one way or the other.
I see a question.
There is retained also to the government a copy of whatever the research data is. But whether the database in this case is that copy, that research data is something that
so I can add a question here.
This is where the threats of recompetition that were circling around yesterday came in, and how real are they, and how achievable would that be if it came down to them? I mean, we heard the Commerce Department talking a little bit about that, and I can't even mention it a little bit. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, my view is the ultimate settlement can be political rather than legal. I mean, it could end up in the courts, but that seems to be a train wreck for everyone, including for Network Solutions, I think, which is watching its stock price, you know, all the time. And in the event of a huge lawsuit, for which they might ultimately lose at the end, could have a very negative impact on their stock price. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly the view of the Department of Commerce that they can rebid this stuff at any time. And, Molly, maybe you can speak to what ICANN's view was.
By the way, excuse me for one second. We didn't mention this at the very beginning, but this meeting is background. If you want quotes from us on stuff, afterwards come talk to us. We'll get quotes. But we really want to be able to be frank in the discussion, so we ask that this not be quotable during the discussion. I don't know if we said that. I think we forgot.
Fair enough.
But anyway.
And after the next
That's
question.
That's important in a room of reporters.
Well, and it's important for us because we actually just want to be able to say, you know, to feel comfortable, not feel like we're.
And after the next couple questions, too, I'd love to just do a reality check and see if this is helpful, if this is actually informative. If it's boring, we could do other things, you know, charades or something.
That was a great
juggling.
Yeah. So, yes. And maybe you can introduce yourself.
My name is Victor Pinto from the Central Quarter News. Would you shed some light on the domain name registration outside the United States? Reportedly, we have 7 places in the United States, or 7, almost getting 11 places around the world, 4 in Europe, and 7 in the United States. How does the Europeans and other countries outside of the United States authority to operate domain name registration?
Well, my quick answer to that is once John had done ISO 3166 and designated these different country-level domains, he would either be approached by a country that would say, somehow he'd get something on nice letterhead, say, we're ready to run the domain, please point the route to this server over in our country, or maybe not. In fact, Tuvalu, I guess, presented such letterhead. But it went to a server in Canada. I actually met the minister from Tuvalu.tv, and he was talking about how he privatized .tv. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. I should send you some email. He said, we don't have email on our island. We're not wired at all. And you're right. We live in a virtual world. So anyway, John, if he gets letterhead, is going to point the root server to some authoritative thing. If he doesn't get letterhead, in times he would hand it to somebody to run in trust. It would be a trustee. And it would just be, you know, somebody he knew and trusted, some guy. A guy in Switzerland ran most of the Central African country codes for a while, and that person would then decide, do I just take anybody who wants to register? Do I charge a fee? Do I not charge a fee? And thus NSI, by the way, has been saying, that's why we shouldn't have country codes and generics. We should have open and closed, domains that take registrations from anybody in charge and domains that don't. And that's the right way to allocate policy between the two. Of course, I think there's been a reluctance to want to try to put any policy into the country codes because then you get into national sovereignty being challenged. So there's a variety of ways that it's done. Is there anybody that wants to add to that from our?
I would add that among the new registrars that ICANN is now crediting to compete with NSI is .com.org.edu, which at least for .com.org are international top-level domains for which anyone can register. Many of the already testbed registrars are not U.S. There's at least one Asian-specific company in that mix. And sort of one of the qualifications that I was looking for when choosing those testbed registrars was an international mix. And I think the thought of now having lots and lots of new registrars in the competitive system is that there'll be some from all over the world. Not that it matters where your registrar is necessarily, but the thinking is that they do companies in various parts of the world will be better equipped to serve customers.
.us, by the way, was held in trust for the United States by John Postel, and to this day is not run by the United States. It's being run by John's successors at IANA in Marina Del Rey, and there's currently a process that the Commerce Department is undergoing to try to figure out which unit of the United States government should run .us and how. And what that meant was, ultimately, you're the mayor of Cambridge, Massachusetts, you'd call John on the phone, ultimately, and say, I'd like cambridge.ma.state.us, and he'd say, you know, I already gave it to the city councilman, please work it out, or something like that. Yeah?
I just have a question. I mean, is there any sense that the U.S. government common charter officials or NSF officials spotted all ahead to this potential conflict with NSI over the Whois database, and that they may one day try to claim ownership of it, and this could be a huge problem, which is where they are now.
Yeah.
Was there any sense that somebody thought ahead about the potential conflict or the train wreck, as you said, down the road?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Is there anything in the white paper that would sort of point to that, saying, yeah, somebody thought ahead about this problem? Or
by the white paper, yeah, they knew by then. In the white paper, there is some language that says that the U.S. government owns it, but by that time...
But then where does NSI come off saying, no, we read this differently? It does not say that, I mean.
Well, the white paper wasn't the contract. The white paper was just kind of a proposal of how things should go forward. So NSI's looking back to the original cooperative agreement and saying, it's not in there, and we don't read it the same way you do.
And it also comes down to semantics when you talk about registry versus registrar, which was a distinction that didn't exist really before. Registry meaning the actual ministerial process of holding the single quill that writes to the magic file that is the comm zone that routes every comm to its location. And registrar being the customer service part where you take in the information and register it. And of course, even before so-called competition, there was that. You might not have gone directly to Network Solutions. What became WorldNIC to register your domain name. You go to somebody else who then would go to Network Solutions and do it, like a travel agent to an airline. That would be, I guess, a lowercase r registrar. And now the idea is there'll be uppercase r registrars that are able to pass the information to Network Solutions directly to go into the zone and pay less as a result, but still pay Network Solutions, at least during this testbed period. Nobody knows what the fee structure will be afterwards, and Commerce and NSI are arguing about that.
There was an update to the cooperative agreement, wasn't there, to go along with the white paper and setting up...
This is Amendment 11.
Right, okay.
And, yeah, Amendment 11...
Well, is there anything in Amendment 11 that envisions this, since that's the working document right now?
Under the original format structure, which most of the contracts were in at the beginning, the default setting at a minimum was given the government the right to use it. And maybe
but it's ambiguous, and Molly, maybe you disagree. I think Amendment 11 is really ambiguous. In order to come to some agreement by the deadline, and by the way, part of it was to extend the original agreement through October 2000, they punted on a lot of the issues. They phrased it intentionally ambiguously, so that either side could try to claim victory, and that's what you see a little bit of happening now.
I might just follow up on what Diane said about the right to use a copy. How is that, or is that different from actual ownership? No, please, anybody.
I think you're right, Tamar. You said exclusivity? Yeah, go ahead.
Doesn't that fall under the FICE decision?
Yes.
Yes.
Legislation that's currently pending that would change that, but currently under copyright law, you can't own a database unless you've added value to it. You've done something to it to make it so that it's more than just a listing of names and addresses.
But aren't the underlying facts not copyright? Well, the way you put the facts together, that manner.
But realize, too, though, that ownership I mean, we're talking about ownership as a legal concept. Ownership is also just who has a gun and can stop somebody from coming at you. And in that case, it's like trade secret. It's just, we have the database, we just cut off access to it. If you could get it, yeah, we couldn't legally stop you from doing something with it, but you can't get it. Yeah. So let me give one ministerial note. For those who are listening to the webcast, the press we have, I don't know how many we have on listening, but the microphones would be helpful if you can speak into them. And I know that Andrew is here from Markle wanting to talk briefly about the nonprofit perspective on this. You guys have some specific policy areas you want to talk about. And I know Tamar wanted to speak a little bit actually to the funding issue. The domain name tax has been on the radar and how funding helps out. So maybe it would make sense to jump to that. Yeah, you might as well.
I actually, unfortunately, am going to have to go soon, so I'll make this brief. But I think this is a good point, actually, to jump in and to make a little bit of a nod to why the Markle Foundation is here. We were just speaking about the difficulty of anticipating sort of where things are going to go in this ICANN process. No one could have predicted years ago the value that would have been in this database. No one could have predicted at the time that these cooperative agreements were signed what kind of import they would have. The Markle Foundation is really actually at an interesting juncture where it's going to be announcing next week a number of its new program focuses and activities. And consistent with that, one of those is a project called Policy for a Network Society. Markle's overall goal, and I want to introduce Julia Moffitt, who mentioned she's here in the back, is our Vice President for Communications and is available to talk to you about the larger Markle focus and agenda. But Markle is generally committed to enhancing the public voice and the consideration and development of public policy in communications, including the Internet. And we're quite concerned about the development of this process and the fact that the nonprofit, the .org and .edu community, if you will, has not been tremendously well represented in the process to date. Now, ICANN, because of its mandate to be accountable to an international constituency of users, both current users and future users, has, I'd say, admirably gone to hold meetings in Singapore and Berlin. Coming up, there's one in South America in Santiago. Part of the difficulty of this, though, is that you have groups that can't really afford to travel to these places. They may look at this entire process and see it as technical, abstruse, not really relevant to them. I'm talking about library associations, educational organizations, consumer groups, service organizations, civil liberties and civil rights organizations. These are the .orgs and .edus that do have a stake in a lot of these issues that have to do with questions of democratic principles, of accountability, of transparency, of openness, of competition, and of course of civil liberties, which our folks from the EFF here can speak to quite well. The Markle Foundation is interested in reaching out to the .org and .edu community and has begun to do so. We held a coordinating meeting yesterday with some leaders from this community, and we'll be continuing to help them to organize themselves in a way that they can have their voice heard. In a sense, if you think about what's happening with ICANN being a kind of constitutional convention for the Internet and cyberspace, we want to make sure that all these folks can get to Philadelphia. And we haven't taken any position on whether ICANN is the right vehicle or not. We just believe in inclusivity and in a process that really takes into account the voices of the public interest, which we think is best represented by these nonprofit and educational organizations. And so we're going to be working further on that, and we just wanted to let you know that we're here if you have questions regarding whether that community is being well enough represented. Obviously, there are challenges. One of them is the international scope of this, which means that we need to reach out to not just library associations and educational organizations here in the U.S., but on an international level. So we'll be back in touch with you, and again, if we can answer questions, we'd be happy to.
My information is pretty sketchy on it. What I've heard is there were other bidders.
NSI was a minority-owned or operated company and was the only bidder that was so designated under the federal procurement rules and was awarded the contract. But I don't know. And it's not clear to me. Well, here's what I said yesterday. This was a surprise to everyone. Network Solutions was not thinking ahead 5 years and saying, boy, are we in for some fun. It was kind of a gold mine that erupted, but they happened to be sitting on top of it. That's just what my sense of it is, but I don't know the detail. I don't know if anybody else knows specifically. So.
But of course, it doesn't matter whether it's NSI or anybody else. They would all act in the same way trying to protect the network.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, particularly once you've got shareholders, they'll sue your socks off if you don't do that, which, yeah, exactly. That's what you wind them up. That's what you have to do. That's the way they go. Yeah. I want to make sure we get to the openness question, too. And at some point, I'm going to ask how many people in the room know who Jeff Williams is, if that name means anything.
He spends all his time filing to the list.
All right, I'll get to that later. Do you guys want to say a few words?
Sure, I'll kind of keep it brief. I definitely want to at least touch on why EFF is involved with this at all, because we're a civil liberties organization, and this is supposed to be some administerial group. That's what ICANN is supposed to be, just administering, coming up with ideas on how the Internet should be administered, the domain name system. But there are some really serious civil liberties implications to a lot of what's going on that don't often get put out there, and we're thinking that maybe if we make you aware of them, it can help you have an angle to get to real people, why they should care about any of this governance stuff. The first one is that domain names is the way your speech gets labeled and put online. If you want people to be able to find who you are, it's through your domain name. And it's so basic and essential to Internet speech. The way it gets governed is really critical to speech. And kind of the reverse of that, it's also the way people, you can use it to find other people's speech. So if people are being denied domain names that are the logical domain name for themselves, it makes it very hard to find them, and it makes it hard to find you. The other thing that we that you've probably noticed playing out is trademark holders believing that trademarks are superior rights to all other legal rights. And that often is another angle that you can get at this whole domain name issue. People having their domain names taken away from them or threats of the domain names taken away from them because someone who has a superior trademark on it claims that they deserve to have it. And one of my favorites, a recent thing that just happened, Joe Abercrombie sent me an email, joe@abercrombie.net, saying that Abercrombie and Fitch just sent him a cease and desist letter, and he also had talked to the guy, John Abercrombie or whatever his first name was, at Abercrombie.org, who also received the same cease and desist letter. Even though Abercrombie and Fitch already had Abercrombie.com, they believed that their trademark in these men's last name meant that they couldn't use those domain names. We found them counsel, and Abercrombie and Fitch stepped back and is no longer going after this. But the whole concept of trademark holders' rights being superior to any other right is not trademark law in the United States or in any other country. This is some brand new thing that is a new phenomenon in the domain name world. It came about, I think, because Network Solutions put their policy out there that gave trademark holders a superior right to domain names, not because that legally that is what should happen. And I think Network Solutions did that because they started getting sued. They were getting sued for giving out the trademarks of people, and they wanted to protect themselves from lawsuits. And so they said, you can have a domain name first come, first serve, but if a trademark holder comes and shows us that they have trademarked the term, you need to show us that you trademarked it first, or we're going to give it over to the other guy, or at least turn the site dark while you guys duke it out in court. That was the first way they described it. So that whole process is something that is new and very different with domain names. From our perspective, the only way that all global top-level domains, which means the .com, .net, .org, .edu, all of them should be reserved for a single trademark holder like McDonald's, is only if there's a strong mark involved. And short of that, the whole point of having several different top-level domains is to make it so that you can have Joe Abercrombie have one of the domain names, and also Abercrombie and Fitch have another one.
In life, trademark doesn't come with identity necessarily, and I think that for us is something we've been talking about a lot, which is one of the things that's going on there. This is the way you identify yourself. Why is trademark?
The problem is what you said. Who determines what the main trademark holder is?
Well, that's a whole other issue, but that's being done in trademark law all the time. There is already law established for doing that.
Well, follow up on that, if you don't mind. Aren't trademarks, service marks, et cetera, at least in the U.S., done on a state-by-state basis?
I don't think so.
There are both federal and state marks.
Okay.
I mean, there's
so wouldn't there be a solution such that if they hold a federal mark, they get the right to that domain? Or if they hold
because there can be many people holding the same trademark in different categories. The World Boxing Association maybe has knockout or doesn't even have to trademark it. But
well, United
Airlines,
but within their own
federal trademark registration is merely a way to establish rights, and so you could actually have not only two different categories, but you could have if there was a Joe's Diner in Los Angeles and Joe's Diner in New York, both could file for federal trademark. Only the regional nature of it would prevent a court from finding confusion, which is the real test, whether consumers are confused as to the origin of the product there.
But also, not every national mark is a famous one. Again, United Airlines versus United Van Lines. Rolex is a famous mark, so far as I know, because if they came up with, Rolex cars, you would actually think, oh, yeah, those Rolex people. Now they've done cars. So.
Well, the other thing is, you don't necessarily want every family to have to go trademark themselves just so they can protect the right to have the domain name. I mean, that's kind of goofy.
But that's from major domain.
Right. I do think that there should be greater protections for when you're talking about this kind of major marks. Although I'm not so, EFF believes that the entire issue of trademarks and domain names should be separated. It was only pulled together because of Network Solutions doing that as to accommodate trademark holders. And it was done without there being any input from the civil liberties community, and there really are strong civil liberties implications to it. And then there are some other issues besides trademarks, which are civil liberties issues. Unless there were more questions, I see people talking. One of them is the new requirements under the ICANN proposals would require you to put an actual address and an actual location of any registrations for domain names. And that's pretty problematic for some of the political speech that's going on around the world where folks who are going against their governments want to put up websites. Right now they can have fake addresses or they can use somebody else, a proxy for them, and this would not be permitted, it looks like, under the new ICANN rules. So we think that there should be some protection for anonymity. You shouldn't ever have to provide a rationale for why you want a particular domain name. If I say I want logcabins.com, I don't need to explain to anybody that I live in a log home. That's none of your business. I should be able to register it. If you're going to suspend if you're going to suspend someone's domain name, that you have to have some sort of legally recognized document, whether it be a court order here, or some sort of legal authority, because it is shutting down somebody's speech, and there should be pretty high-level protections for that. If somebody wants to defend their use of a particular domain name, that it should be in a convenient forum. They shouldn't be required to travel to Virginia if they live in Sri Lanka. That top-level registrars should be immune from liability, that they shouldn't be
held liable if a domain name is given to someone and then a trademark holder or somebody else comes along and says that that wasn't a legitimate giving of it.
Okay. Any other questions on that? Molly, I know you might have actually a different view, too.
Well, I maybe have some overarching say, but one specifically on the privacy issue. Just for the history of the intent of the drafters, in case it's ever comes up in litigation, it's ICANN's understanding that it is possible under the contract to privately arrange with an agent to register a domain name on your behalf. That agent will have to supply contact information for both technical and potentially legal reasons. But they can have, basically anyone who signs up for a domain name can let someone else license it used to someone else. And that is one, a continuation of current practice. And two, although I think maybe for political reasons, it's not explicit in the contract that it was our hope that that practice would be able to continue for the purpose of privacy.
There's still a problem, though. You can't use a P.O. box, right? You have to use an actual address.
The person who actually registers the name on your behalf does.
Right. So, if I wanted to register for myself and put a P.O. box because I'm working from home, for example, I would have to actually put a street address instead of a P.O. box.
I believe that's right.
So there's still some privacy problems with it. But thanks for the clarification.
And I guess if I can launch off of that,
okay.
I've been trying to think about why working for ICANN was so hard and why being ICANN is so difficult. And I think one of the reasons is that there's a lot of built-up demand for policy work from people on both sides of various issues. For example, the trademark issue, there are some libertarians who think that the NSI policy is unfair because trademark trumps everything else. Trademark people don't think that the NSI policy is ideal because they don't want their names put on hold, they want them right away. They don't want people to be able to do first come, first serve. They want sort of a preemptive strike against people who have registered their names. So there's that issue. There's kind of Amanda Johnson's claim for new GPLDs. And so I think when the white paper came out, sort of motivated by what we hear commonly from the Clinton administration, the idea of letting the private sector lead, letting a lean, nimble, fast-acting company that works on internet crime take over some of these policy issues, I think that led to the expectation that finally some of these questions will get resolved and I'll get to go into the DOPS per business or the NSI policy will get fixed and so on. So with that as background, there are a lot of people who are expecting ICANN to actually get some stuff done. And at the same time, and
Can I just ask you quickly, Molly? ICANN is lately on this riff of, we're just a consensus organization. I mean, do you think that these things always end up in consensus, and when they don't, does ICANN have to come down one side or the other in the absence of consensus?
There are certainly some of these issues that will not certainly get the support of them. We are in some trouble to find consensus, but there are real disagreements. For example, there are real disagreements about what kind of contact information you should have to supply. The trademark lobby has strong views about how easy it should be business on the internet. There are really different views about the nature of the internet. Those who use it mainly for commercial purposes, I think, largely see it as bad and think that requirements that you often have to fulfill to do business in the real world, that it's not unreasonable to impose similar requirements to use the domain name, which is certainly not a consensus. So with that, by way of background, there's a lot of people anxious for ICANN to do something, although they don't agree about what ICANN should do. So that's one reason it's difficult to be ICANN, because there are issues on which there is not consensus, but there is anticipation and push for policy to be made. So there's that substantive difficulty, but at the same time, there's a procedural difficulty that now that ICANN is really getting going, people are waking up to the government-like implications implications of ICANN's power and calling for the procedural protections that government has. Due process, open meetings, some sort of voting, representation, accountability to a global user base. And those are the type of things that make government big and slow and complicated and bureaucratic. And I don't mean to say by that that ICANN shouldn't adopt those things. But they do call into question whether ICANN will in fact fill what the white paper seems to call for in terms of a private sector quick decision maker that will sort of deal with this backlog of policy decisions. So I think at every turn ICANN has both difficult substantive questions to deal with and also this tension between building the structure for fair and open decision making and actually making decisions. The last thing that ICANN wants to do, taking over from this ad hoc IETF style system, is slow down the internet's development by not making decisions that were, you know, being made on a sort of quiet, ad hoc, but usually satisfactory way by internet experts. And they don't want to be accused of messing that up. But at the same time, I personally, and I think the Berkeley Center's view in general, is that it's good for all of us to wake up to the political implications of architecture and administration, technical management. I think it's ICANN's official phrase for it. But they are real political questions.
But ICANN does contribute to this a little bit by saying, we're not doing governance. It's not governance. It's all I mean, that's just not true, right?
Right. There are no contracts and it's not governance.
Well, she's a former staffer. I can put her on the spot now.
I think that fudging reflects the difficult position that the folks who want ICANN to act quickly don't want to hear about ICANN being a government accountable, open, and so forth. And I think actually one of the difficulties is the more ICANN puts in place new process systems and so forth, the more it starts looking like a government, the more it starts getting called a government, the more people want more of that kind of stuff. And I think there is a limit to what should be done. But I think it's an understandable, being overly cautious piece of language.
Okay. Tamar, you wanted to say, why don't we get a mic over to you?
Yes,
okay.
There's
a question? Sorry.
Yeah, this is kind of unrelated to what Molly was just talking about, but I think other reporters here would be interested to know if anybody has any opinion on what type of impact you think yesterday's hearing might have on the current situation, if any. I think I'll just be interested.
Yeah, so what other reporters think, too, because you guys have been covering this. Anybody? Yesterday's hearing?
We weren't there.
You weren't there. I guess I was there. I was sitting there terrified most of the time, but I was there. I'll give you my view. Looking at yesterday's hearings, which from the title, what I took to be was there were going to be some hard questions asked of ICANN. You know, what the hell are you doing, ICANN? And from the distribution of emails that took place as the hearing unfolded, I assume they were really looking to say, you know, ICANN, aren't you overstepping your bounds here, here, and here? And again, it might have just been because I was so terrified as the morning panel, the first panel, went from just kind of, you know, all right, it's testimony to like this really tense moment where Jim Rutt from Network Solutions said, you know, this is my first time testifying. I'm so pleased to be here. And I mean, I just wish I could have watched the NetSol ticker as each question got answered. And I did. I went up to somebody from Network Solutions afterwards, and I just said, you know, if you guys don't can him tonight, I'll be curious why. I mean, I don't know what the long-term implications are. But if you'd ask Central Casting to send over, you know, a kind of rude, simple country boy, like, you know, let me get back to you on that, Congressman. I mean, just, wow. And this is just a rhetorical analysis. I'm not saying they're right or they're wrong. But from a rhetorical analysis of the room, I just thought, you know, and I don't know, I did a quick scan of the headlines last night, and certainly that appeared to be some of the view among the press, at least, that it turned into an NSI grilling session. Some of the things said ICANN and NSI both called to task on various things. And also others it's not this Republican-Democrat thing, which I'm actually curious from the press point of view. I mean, sometimes, I guess there's always, it's
well, I think
turns
it was
into the horse race.
To note that it was just the Democrats that did the grilling on NSI. I mean, but the Republicans sent their side. I mean, they didn't try to refute what the Democrats were doing, which oftentimes, if you've attended a lot of hearings, they will try to do that. So I thought that was interesting.
My take on it was that the congressional Democrats, and I wrote this in my story, kind of hijacked the hearing a little bit, but then as what was complete, continuously evasive, I don't think the Republicans really wanted to get on his side about things. I think his reaction, I think, scared off any defense of his company by the congressman. I mean, even Bill Bray, who started out asking questions about ICANN, turned around and started asking questions about NSI after the first round of questions.
He's a Republican.
Yeah. So, I mean...
The thing
about this is I think this hearing would have had a different tone. This is just my take. If Bliley had stayed around, Bliley gave his opening statement, asked some questions, and then left. And Bliley doesn't like. Well, I mean, I don't know what Bliley likes or not, but Bliley's letters certainly indicate that he's not super fond of ICANN, and that he's got some real questions about it. He calls the $1 fee an illegal tax. Oh, certainly, but he left. He got up and he walked out of the room, and he's certainly the most ardent supporter of NSI. His letter asked ICANN and Commerce how, sort of asking pointed questions about how ICANN had dealt with NSI in the past, and then he asked his questions about the $1 fee. And also, I think ICANN took the wind out of the sails of its detractors a little bit by 2 days before the hearing saying, oh, we're not going to charge a dollar fee anymore. You know, your biggest concern about us is now over. Now ask your questions. You know, so Bliley still asked the question, but it had a lot less weight. I mean, the biggest anti-ICANN thing that came out, frankly, was the Sims, you know,
I disagree that that was that big of a deal.
I'm saying it was the biggest thing that came out, though. I mean, it was like everything else got cut, was really kind of muted about ICANN.
I thought the fact that the tables were turned on NSI were a little more significant.
Oh, I do, too. I personally wrote Sister Rat. I thought the Sims thing was an interesting sidebar, but definitely the interesting thing was the...
You were there. Do you think it will have any impact on ICANN's actions in these negotiations?
The DOC.
DOC.
Well, I guess the next milestone to watch for is this end of the test bed period, right? There's this test bed period, which is just a really bizarre side note to all of this, but right now in the middle. It's the period in which other capital R registrars are to be using this new shared registration system, new software that NSI is writing in its registry capacity, and for which it said it's spending millions of dollars on, it didn't actually have figures, but millions of dollars on this new system. And so far there are 5 accredited testbed registrars. In fact, without this accreditation thing, ICANN wouldn't even be in the middle of it, so far as I know. The only role ICANN has was to give this accreditation to registrars, meant to just look at their business model and say, are you fly-by-night? Could somebody try to register a name with you and find that you're just, you know, a snake oil salesperson, and then you fold up your tent? So there were applications that came forward. ICANN accredits. Now, I think Network Solutions rhetorically was also saying, we reserve the right to let people in who aren't accredited, but they haven't tried to do that yet. Commerce's view is they have to be accredited before they can be let in. By the way, these accreditation contracts, which in their narrowest form would just be, are you stable, and questions designed to get at that, are the hook through which ICANN can actually regulate. I mean, they can say, you can't be accredited unless you also agree to the following things. And some of the agreements will be, you have to agree to force particular kinds of contracts upon your downstream registrants, people like you and me registering names. So in a way, this accreditation is not just an instrument of assuring stability, but the regulatory hook that ICANN actually has to reach down from the root and affect every name. But in any case, this testbed period is ending. The Department of Commerce and Network Solutions negotiated the registry fee. This is the $9 a year, but it's still a 2-year registration, $18 collected by NSI up front. Odd, since NSI's franchise, by DOC's reckoning, ends on October 2000. How are they collecting 2 years up front? But that was the agreement between DOC and NSI. that thing was due to expire. The testbed was supposed to end. It would go to general registrations this month or even last month. It's been extended and extended. The next deadline is, I think, August 6th or August 8th or something. My guess is it will be extended again. But the reason why, the big sticking point is, what will the price ceiling agreed on between DOC and NSIB? And I have no idea how they're even conducting that negotiation. Do they just sit across the table and NSI says $8 and they say $1? NSI says $8 and they say $1. So they've assigned some economists to say this is how much we think. My own view, again, personally, is I cannot for the life of me understand why you are renting the name, why you're paying by the year. You ought to be able to buy the damn thing and be done with it. Or imagine, if it's the question is, how can a registry recover its costs for doing its business? Maybe it should get a lump sum for each registrar it has to support, since costs scale as you add new registrars, or something like that. But the idea that you're charging by the name and on a regular basis, I just don't understand. But anyway, that's the fee that is in contention. And if DOC and NSI cannot agree on that fee, what DOC does is they extend the testbed period a little longer.
Do you own the name, or are you licensing it anyway?
You're licensing it because they can take it away from you. They do take it away.
Or if you fail to renew it, then it reverts back to them. But
so that's why they're charging for the year. Right.
Which then becomes public. You need the right to set up your website under that name.
No, they don't give you the right to do that.
But you couldn't set up that website with that name unless you were given that
right to
get that name, right?
At least, just
at least on the internet.
Right.
And this is as good an opportunity to briefly mention multiple routes as any. There are those who say, well, wait a minute. You know, this thing only works not because it's the law. You know, it's not like it would be illegal to get your name resolution from somebody else with a different list. It's just that nobody wants it. If you're using a different, you know, list that no one else pays attention to, you'll hand out your name on a business card and it'll go to where NSI points it. But there are those who still say, because there could exist multiple routes, you know, that's the real solution. Somehow we need to have there be competition among even name resolution services.
Okay, namespace that is registering things under .sex and .news.
Right, and indeed, because of the fragmentation, there are multiple little guy claimants to, like, .web. And, you know, there's one guy who says, I'm .web, and I'm registering the names, and I'm going to sue you, some other little guy, who you say you're .web. And, I mean, it's a fight over a very small pie slice, because .web doesn't even exist as far as most of us are concerned. But to be sure, you could enter a little thing into your Windows network control panel that would direct your domain name resolution services to one of these alternate routes. And then suddenly, if you pointed it to the right route, .web would resolve to somewhere else.
I think an important point, and this is very sort of, this is more philosophical. We're not really involved in the ICANN business. All the contractual stuff, you know, is not something I spend a lot of time with. But I've been a really long time IETF member, and I've been involved with the internet through from very early days at Rutgers, and I'm a technologist. And we've moved from a way of making decisions from things that seemed reasonable. If this seems reasonable, this is how we operate. It was sort of like a really good code of conduct. It was a really nice way to behave with each other, and that's how the whole thing ran. And what happened, and as Jonathan rightly pointed out, as it became more commerce-driven, and the businesses joined the standards bodies and started to take over more of the standards processes, and started to become more concerned from a trademark perspective. It wasn't that decisions weren't being made on a seems reasonable basis. It was being made on a, it's more important for business to have these than the seems reasonable basis. And so I think what is happening with some of this policy re-leveling is how do we get back to a seems reasonable at a higher order, but no longer on a personal level, but at now at a civil society level of a, how do we make things reasonable, more standard.
I don't see how, it's hard. I mean, law and reason are often quite the vote.
This is actually why I think when you say the ICANN process is hard, I think this is the same hard stuff that's going to happen with all of these things returning into more self-regulated, more open governance kinds of issues. as we go from a casual construction or a technical construction,
now,
it's reasonable to more proper.
Now, work. Tamar had the mantle of trying to herd cats during this IFWP process, where it was, you know, how do you be reasonable? I'm sure you've got thoughts on this. Let me try to get the mic over to her.
There is no doubt, and that's what Molly has shown, yes, that icon is in the search of its identity. And the identity is different than anything we have seen before. We know about corporations, yes, and we know that the board meetings are closed, and we know that there is a shareholder meeting which is open. We also know about political organizations, how Congress behaves. We know how professional organizations behave. We have here an animal that it has the functions of almost all of them. And on top of it, it has different cultures. And it has a global effect. So it's not surprising that it is difficult. But I think one of the reasons and one of the things that were very distressing when I found myself really involved in this was the lack of trust that people had in each other. It could very well be that it was because they are so different. But the result was, and this is something that the language will not resolve, it is if you say something and I mistrust you, then I will interpret it very differently than if I trust you. And what you saw was that every statement was of that sort. There was a mistrust. Now, what happened in these meetings were some ground rules, and the ground rules were that I don't want to hear what you disagree about. I want to hear what you agree about. The rest throw out. That was number one. And the second ground rule was, if you want to be empowered, then you have to undertake some responsibility. And the third ground rule was that if you have a rule you want to establish, you must be able to live with that rule if you are in the minority and not in the majority. And therefore, the rule must be such that you could not design it while you are at the helm. What happened at those meetings was that people got enough satisfaction to try and do something about it. There was one more thing, and that is that they were fighting about who is going to be on the board. Instead, we focused on what are the ground rules for the board to act, and the more ground rules we establish, the less worried we are about this enormous discretion that the board would have. And that is really what happened. I think that governments can act efficiently. I don't believe that if you decide on a policy matter, you can't have it open. On the other hand, and that we have to remember, if you have a closed meeting, people can allow themselves to change their minds. And that is why we have closed meetings in the courts, in the juries. You can say, "Ooh, I was wrong. I listened now to what you've said, and it's different." Yes? So I changed my mind. If I talk to the press, to you guys, then I'm not going to say that. So negotiations, especially if they don't affect anybody else, should be in closed sessions. I think ICANN should have an executive session. At the other hand, if you have a decision on policy, it should be open. Yes, it would take a little more time, so be it. What ICANN needs now is more legitimacy. It needs more recognition of more trust. And it can achieve it by these measures. And finally, let me make a suggestion. I've been thinking how can I can raise money and at the same time not seem to impose a tax, and especially not seem to be in a position kind of fighting with NSI, which lowers it to a for-profit organization, not a not-for-profit organization. And one way to do it, they can ask for contributions from the MacArthur Foundation, from other foundations, and these foundations are very good at monitoring what is done with the money. That's their expertise. And once you do that, you can acquire the kind of support, not necessarily for the decisions that they make, but for them, for the profit. Why do we obey the law? We don't always agree. Well, I don't want to pay taxes, but I pay. I think it's right. And that is because the process is right, because I think it's fair, more or less. Yeah.
What would happen if, you know, groups like that stop getting ICANN money? Isn't like a $1 charge for every name more kind of steady flow, dependable source of income?
Well, you know, United Ways has been around for how long? Years and years and years?
But United Way doesn't necessarily serve a function that has to be continually. I thought United Way doesn't work.
Oh, yes. There's so many people are dependent upon it. But
sure,
I'll tell you what.
Internet societies depend on it. There are funding sources based on the kindness of others. So, and especially if they start stepping on toes.
I think that ICANN will then have to be more sensitive to, first of all, ICANN is an experiment, and it will probably be an experiment at least until the year, 2003 or 2002. It's just a three-year experiment. It's not yet done. It is evolving. During that experiment, let's see if it works. And let's see if the foundations all over the world will be willing to chip in, what is it they need, $6 million? $6 million. Both private, I would limit the contributions of corporations, especially those who may capture. So it's not that I can give you a design. But there are so many institutions that have been around for so long, supported by it.
You know, I actually would argue against that. I think from, I sit on the board of trustees, which many of you guys know what trustee is, which is also a nonprofit, which is also a self-governance or self-regulation sort of an organization that's doing assurances. And where I agree that there are funding issues that go in when we're all starting to create these new kinds of things, we had to go out like annual beggars and go to people and say, can you give us money to start this? We think we really need to do this. And we got it. We got the first, you know, bunch of cash to do the startup, which is what you need. But then you set into play some way for an annuity so that it can be self-perpetuating, because the reality is then you have to make sure that there are good governance roles for rotation of the board, good governance roles for oversight. What do you do when something goes slightly awry in a nonprofit? But these are all very normal nonprofit governance things that I think any of us who sort of, I don't come out of that tradition, I've actually had to learn it in the last year or so. And there are a lot of really interesting oversight mechanisms there, but I think as we move into these self-governance, self-regulatory, unusual beasts, annuity streams, and making sure that it's self-sustainable revenue, I actually think we have to figure out how to do that.
If I'm not mistaken, I'm in a really bad cash crisis right now. They're down there in the hole of between, $800,000, and they've got all these expenses they're expecting to have go out. I mean, it just strikes me that it's not like it's going to be a problem a couple years down the road. They're not paying their bills now, today. So, I mean, the question is and since they've suspended the feed about a political pressure, which is obvious, they said they did. It wasn't even a day. They said we suspended the fee because Commerce Department said we should, and Commerce Department said suspend the fee because even though we think it's a good idea, we know that it's getting a lot of people angry.
So what are they going to do even as a stopgap measure from now till sort of the, you know, the next time a bill comes due? I mean, it's off, they owe just him $500,000, and he seems to be comfortable with just letting that fly on credit, but they have $300,000 that are going to, you know, vendors and staff members. So, I mean, does anybody here have any idea whether ICANN's going to be able to find some sort of bridge funding? They said that at the meeting that two people have agreed to pay the $1 fee even though they're not charging the $1 fee right now.
Very good. Maybe that will start the kind of voluntary payment that is needed. Exactly. They may get even more if they do it that way rather than the other way.
But if they don't get that dollar fee from NSI, which is obviously the one that has most of the domain names, then it's going to be kind of meaningless anyway, especially until he's going to start having some significant amount of market share, which isn't likely they're going to do with NSI being where it is.
I don't know how much was theatrics, but I was definitely hearing rumblings of a cancellation of the Santiago meeting if they didn't get some money sometime soon because they just couldn't even pay to rent the room. That kind of thing. Molly, do you have any insight into it that you'd be willing to share?
I can confirm that at least when I left, there were cash problems and, I mean, general discomfort with the stopgap measures of, you know, basically seeking donations from anyone, particularly targeting internet-interested companies, although not necessarily the ones that are most interested in the policy.
I mean, AOL
decision.
Fit into this GIP.
I think that's right.
AOL was
IBM, MCI, Microsoft are all donors, and no one thinks that that's ideal because they've run out of money already, for one thing, and also because it raises questions about capture and so forth. And, you know, I think ICANN's thinking all along was that there would be some sort of structure where the registrars and registries who relied on the services, you know, the just small amount of services that ICANN provides on a yearly basis would somehow kick in, either, you know, not necessarily on a per domain name basis, but on some
basis. Well, there are
basis.
The initial accreditation fees, right?
Right.
$5,000.
Right.
Next time, 50 or something?
I don't know what the current number is, but that's...
Is that a yearly?
No.
Just a one time?
That's yearly, yeah.
Oh,
I'm reading here from the accreditation agreement.
Oh, go to the document.
For the initial one-year term of this agreement, shall be $5,000.
So it adds an interesting twist to the political landscape. You know, for a variety of reasons, NSI wants to slow down, you know, for a variety of legitimate reasons, NSI might want to slow down ICANN's progress, but it puts ICANN in a pickle if that slowdown in getting companies accredited and getting people to pay at least their annual fees, their bulk fees, not their per domain name fees, could make it impossible for ICANN to do business.
I guess the question before, if that came to post-mortem of that thing, everybody saw that sort of NSI had dealt a blow and came out with that on their face, but if what happened was that ICANN said, okay, we're going to bat pressure with the Commerce Department, which came from pressure from Brad Lilly, which came from pressure from NSI, I mean, which is the only company that I've heard that actually approved, the only major company that I've heard that actually has approved of the $1 fee, then hasn't NSI kind of, in a sense, even though they came out looking bad in the hearing, kind of won the war where they may have lost the 2-hour battle and looked bad in front of Congress? Have they gotten what they wanted in making sure this fee is suspended for now and they get to go again? And I guess they've deferred this to a task force that's going to try to come up with another funding mechanism. But
it sounds like Commerce is going to have to come through with some money.
That would be something to watch for, whether
yeah.
Commerce actually manages.
I mean, they sort of alluded to that in their letter.
But they didn't make any good promises in their letter. They said,
well, I think they need to find the money.
We're going to try to find out. We're going to try to help find a way to find money.
Well, it's their idea, all of this, so they want to keep up with it, so there's got to be solutions.
It's not, just because I'm a business person, these are not really expensive things to run. From a relative cost perspective, usually when we start up something like this, the first year is around $1 million, the second year is around $5 million, more or less. I mean, that's how startups work, you know, that's from the Valley. And
And then after that, running a nonprofit organization with, you know, sort of under 10 people with like $1.5 million a year.
But it has meetings worldwide and exotic locations.
Now, well, see, that actually, you know, that actually becomes the question. Do you use the technology better if you're going to deal with a global organization? Or, you know, how does representation get funded to go and things like that? It's not necessarily the responsibility of whatever group brings them together to do that. And there may be scholarship stuff, there may be membership, there may be, museums, it's not required frequently that you pay, but it's in a donation structure. I mean, there's a lot of flexibility and room for an organization to fund, is what I'm trying to say. So, well, I hear a lot of sort of noises about sounding dire on this. This is not a big deal. I mean, and I don't mean to sort of cast it aside, just looking at it from, how does it normally work in startups? How much does it normally cost? How does it work in nonprofits? How much does it normally cost? This is within the realm of very normal right now.
How many startups are being sort of watched in every move by the Commerce Department?
In the Valley, a lot of them.
But I mean, honestly. Yeah.
No, not in the same way, but a lot of nonprofits end up being looked at that way, depending on what they're trying to do. No, I mean, you know, it depends. I know with folks like Trustee and BBB Online, there was a lot of attention, and there was a lot of meetings all over the place, because we were trying to do something that, you know, has a lot of things that the governments, not only in the U.S., but around the world, are very concerned about right now. And so these things are part of this new kind of thing that's going to happen, and how they get funded is part of the questions that are going to get asked over the next 5 years. And ICANN's job is actually, in some ways, smaller than some of the other ones that will end up emerging, I think.
Yeah, I had a question on a related topic for Diane. Can you tell us what kind of progress is being made on ICANN, and maybe Molly could pitch in, you know, representing medicines around the world?
Thank you. ICANN appointed a committee of 13 total, and we spent 6 months slogging through a host of very tough issues. If ICANN is going to have a democratic elected component, proposed half of the board be democratically elected, what is going to be the cost and the burden of implementing that if it's worldwide? How, if we want to do it online, take advantage of the medium, how do we know the person registering isn't a spoofed identity?
Who, the Jeff Williams issue.
Right, yeah. I mean, if you can just type in whoever you are, how do we know who you are, really? How do we should corporations and organizations have a vote? In Europe, most of the domain owners are commercial. They're not individuals. And actually, I've heard most of the ones here are also, but I don't have data on that. So if we set up this people's portion of the board, where do these corporations speak? And that leaves out, you know, most of Europe. So trying to decide those issues were what we debated. When you open your enrollment to the public to be members, how do we know if it's been captured? How do we know it's not Microsoft enrolling all their employees? When do we know that it's really representative, and how far back can you go into the information of the member to determine that?
Is it a membership organization?
The structure that we recommend is a membership organization. Under California nonprofit law, if you have the right to elect a director of the corporation, you get a host of rights that are equivalent to shareholder ownership. You can bring derivative actions, you can call special meetings, so that a lot of the rights that were left out when ICANN was originally set up come in through setting up a membership structure. And, you know, how is that going to work if, you know, this organization that needs to decide right away, yes, you can use HTTP, or yes, we ought to be able to expand the IP address space so there are more numbers. If you can have a shareholder bring a suit saying, well, I don't like that, that doesn't affect me, And if they're a shareholder, they can make ICANN pay for the cost of the suit. So you end up with a paralyzed, crippled organization if it's open to all this. And yet you want your share, you want your owners to have some rights. So balancing this is what the membership looked at. And we don't have great answers for all of those questions. Some are toss-ups. Some are just business judgments. We only have so much money. We can't verify that. You know, people in Africa don't have ID cards. So, and there's no way to verify that it really is, you know, Nam so-and-so at Village X. The issue of fees for members was very hotly contested. The third world says, look, you know, we can't afford it. There's no way. And so if you say, well, okay, we'll only charge you $1 for membership. And they say, well, excuse me, we don't want to be second-class citizens, depending on your largesse, you know, you wealthy Westerners. And when you decide you don't want to pay that anymore, you kick us off. So the issue of cost recovery was part of that, and how you play that around globally. But the biggest problems that we ran into also had to do with minority versus majority rights. If the access to membership and how that would affect who the majority is. You know, if access requires a fee, that affects who the majority is. It's the wealthy people. If the access is through identity, you know, it affects who can prove their identity. We have a huge report, which no one has read, I'm sure. But if you do have a chance to look at some of those issues, and if you have solutions that we couldn't find because we only had so much time to work, it was an international community. We had to work in email space, which is terrible because it's really slow. Teleconferences. You don't know who wants to speak next. No one waves their hand in a teleconference. So we only had a little bit of time to talk as a group, and that's a real handicap.
What's going to happen now? Is it an ongoing, you file the report and that's it?
I'm sorry, thank you. You get right to the point.
Yeah.
In Berlin, we proposed what we thought the principles of the at-large membership should be, that it should be open to any user. You know, the opposition said it should only be open to registered domain holders. There should not be a fee. There should and we had a list of 18 principles. And ICANN said, thank you. We would like to implement those principles if we can. There are still some legal issues that have to be researched. Can you do proxy voting online? Is it valid under California law? They deferred it to the staff to study for purposes of implementation. And Greg Crew, who's one of the board members, volunteered to take that on, and he asked Berkman if we would help draw up the specs. What is it going to cost to put this online and, you know, at least put a membership on the table and come up with those figures by Santiago, so they have something to present. So that's where we are, trying to find out what the cost would be and how we'd do it.
So I'm mindful of the time. I was thinking we should go to 11:30. What we could do is kind of have a hard close to our formal informal session, and then be happy to stick around and have an informal informal session as long as people are interested in. But I think the one question we want to ask you guys is this useful? And really get an honest answer, because, you know, we had to go to trouble to put it together. You had to go to trouble to spend a couple hours here. And as Tara and I were talking it over, we were thinking it actually might be nice to have a series of roundtables kind of like this on a number of different issues. We got ICANN. I mean, it's a whole bunch of cyber issues that each of us can either speak to or gather some.
They're incredibly dense issues.
Yeah.
And it just feels like we need a couple of hours to sit around, you know, kind of like bring everybody up to speed on.
So we're willing to do that, but I love an honest assessment. Is it due to us? You know, did this help?
I think this was very useful. I was just hoping you could do one thing before this breaks up. Can you just crystallize for me, the group here, what you think are the most likely outcomes of this dispute in 1 year or 2 years from now?
I'm willing to throw in. I'm willing to throw in some options.
We have worked on that.
In fact, to be honest, I don't think I can make it. I just
wouldn't mind. So we can call you.
How about not what I said about your brunch?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. We live in an open environment. I've got a lot to walk, so.
Okay.
Be kind. But I don't mean to pressure you guys.
No, that's okay. I mean, I just wanted to make sure.
We didn't want this to be an event.
Yeah, this is not like the press event. You're not supposed to cover what we're talking about. We're just talking, you know?
Right. I hope it works. We have announcements or something.
Yeah.
Unveil the new concept car.
We don't have any good news. We just
want
to talk.
Yeah.
So just to clarify, we can, from this point, we can sort of be on the record and get some story out of it. So
details of how this all came together, and we could ask maybe stupid questions that we've been always needing to ask, so that was good.
And your questions are up for it.
They're not.
They always are, though.
And one thing we had, too, on the openness front was, do we let it be known that we're having a press session? We're not interested, in somehow sneakily having a discussion that then is, in this particularly ICANN DNS environment. So we did let it be known we were having a session. I heard word going around the hearing room yesterday. And interestingly, we didn't get partisans showing up wanting to have their time. Had they shown up, we weren't exactly sure. We didn't want to turn them away. They could listen in and hear what we were doing and criticize us if they think we're getting it wrong. But exactly how to share mic time when there are others in the room that desperately want their points to be heard was a tough question. And one that I guess will be answered another day, since it just happened that show up. And I'm not sure whether openness means just open access or open participation within a synchronous environment. There's only so much mic time, and there are people who will take all of it given the chance. We had that at an open meeting in January, one woman who comes to all of these things already out of New York, and she will use the mic until she is told, "I'm sorry, you have to stand down." And you all know what I'm talking about.
So, 2 years,
my remarks were, you can, whatever the degree you want, they were on the record. And Markle is also available, I guess, before to talk about his process and whether it's meeting public needs and how the .org and .edu community can be more fully represented, and also, generally, the public role of Internet governance.
Yeah. So all that said, I guess, in conclusion, what are the scenarios for how this could end up 6 months or a year from now? Do you want to go first, Carrie?
I think my only perspective on it, what's going to happen with these entities, I'll leave that piece to you. I think for me, the bigger question is what's going to happen with addressing and domain names? Because I think with IP6, with Jonathan alluded to, with being able to address every atom and every toaster, how that evolves and how sort of directory schemes evolve, how do you find things is really the question. And so do the real names like objects and the Yahoos of the world and the IBMs and whoever else in whatever language create these directory super schemes on the top and these numbering systems on the bottom, the numbers are attached to things and who puts them back together? That for me is really the bigger question here. And a lot of that, I really would say to look to what's going on in some of the private sector stuff in directories and look at the technologies that are directory-oriented and look at the technologies that are about how do you find things. Because that's really what a lot of this discussion is about. And in 2 years, depending on what happens with the technology, how you find things may make a lot of this discussion old.
And another interesting note on IPv6 that I was having Ben look into as our tech person is apparently when you go on Ethernet, you get what's called a MAC code, machine access code, or media access code, and it's unique to every single Ethernet card. Talk about somebody who holds the quill. There's somebody that's actually coordinating between Precom and Viking and all the people making cards.
Or you can carry it with your Intel Pentium 3 processor.
Yeah, so exactly. Each Ethernet card, though, has its own code. IPv6, as we're understanding it, sends that code along with the IP address. Every packet you send. So your machine, as it's walking around the internet and clicking on things, gets known. I mean, it's the permanent cookie.
Talk about major privacy.
Yeah, and I mean, your machine then can get a rep, or at least your Ethernet card can. And you know, you don't want to use someone else's Ethernet card. You don't know where it's been and what they're going to expect of you. And that, again, this is a wonderful example of the tech, and it might make sense to do it for authentication security purposes, but the tech and the politics obviously are...
Give me a black market for clean Ethernet cards.
Yeah, exactly. I can scrub right. Yeah, exactly. Dial-up is still a fake, or at least a non-unique MAC code that gets generated.
At the same time, I guess you want to watch the other side of that. Anyone with a static IP address that's in your computer is on the network all the time, the way ours and Harvard certainly are. Or if you have a cable modem, you have an IP address that stays with you all the time and can be tracked in exactly the same way. Giving all the same information except maybe what manufacturer made your network card.
It might actually be to share your IP address within your local community and then everybody has plausible deniability to submit a question. That must have been my neighbor. And also, I've just finishing up the syllabus for my fall class. I'm happy if there's interest to make it available. Just my best guess at what the next big issues are going to be. I'm trying to keep this interesting as possible for my students in fall. So I'm happy to circulate that around generally. Anyway, back to 6 months from now. One possibility is ICANN tanks. It goes bankrupt, the board just quits and says, you know, what do we need? The headaches. Or it is put out of its misery. Any of those could happen.
Do you think that's an either or?
How's that?
is it one of the other? Are you saying it's one of the other?
Oh, no. Okay. This is one group of possibilities.
Okay.
I'm not predicting this. That's
okay.
What I can predict. No, this is just one possible path. That basically it was chartered as an experiment. Everybody agrees to that. The white paper was a daring, I mean, is, you know, much of a kind of straightforward guy, Iron Magazine or Teams, is actually quite a daring thing he did. And he did it by covering a lot of spaces. I mean, you know, talking to the European Commission and, you know, trying to get everybody on board. And I'm in fact amazed at the way, at least until recently, that the white paper has been treated as kind of the island of stability in this. You'll have people screaming at each other, and what they're screaming about is whether their view of the white paper is right versus the other view, but neither of them questions the veracity of the white paper until recently. I've seen kind of cracks in that. So anyway, one scenario is ICANN tanks. And if it does, what happens? You could imagine son of ICANN. You know, we'll just go back to the drawing board and try again. My guess is that the roughly 250 people that travel the world to each of these meetings that are intensely into DNS politics just don't have the stomach to try it again. So I don't see how a son of ICANN would come about, primarily because I don't... The mistakes that ICANN has made... they're not why. I mean, they're what you'd expect. I'm not sure how a new ICANN would necessarily be any better. And therefore, people might not be inclined to try it again since the first one failed. A second possibility, were it to tank then, would be government regulation. Just say, all right, the Department of Commerce is just going to try to run this thing. It's going to continue doing direct contracts with network solutions, with or whomever else, if it rebids the registry and wins the war and it's right to do so, it just continues to manage it by contract. In a way, the way it's been doing it, even in this period, it's not like ICANN's been making any policy. They've been accrediting some registrars. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Molly, they haven't actually done anything yet except meet a lot.
Well, there's policy embedded in those contracts as well. Right, they've been stalling.
Yeah. So, in essence, during that interstitial time, the internet keeps running because, you know, the Commerce Department has been extending the various... So you keep with the bailing wire and the twine to keep it rolling as long as you can. The problem is that there may be international pressure on how governments can really all cooperate on it. And there's certainly, again, in the registration part of it, pressure from other countries to just get a piece of the action. The idea that it's all in either, you know, Reston, Virginia or Marina Del Rey, California just doesn't sit well. And from what I've heard,
certainly the part of the white paper that says this should be headquartered in the United States, but should not be, you know, specifically privileged with respect to United States law. I can imagine that they like hammered that out really carefully in various closed door sessions that I wasn't a part of. So government regulation is one result that would come if ICANN failed, one possibility. A third possibility would be in the absence of the Commerce Department getting its act together, imagine that the contracts just lapse or something. It either lands in the courts, and the courts have to make a kind of case-by-case decision as to what's going on, specifically with the existing registrars. And at that point, you would have two backstops. One backstop would be antitrust. You'd actually have DG4 from the European Commission, or you'd have the United States government or others, or even the individual states taking an interest to the extent that there are monopolies involved and questions about abuse of monopoly power. You go after them for antitrust, and then you get a remedy of divestiture or something like that. A judge basically writes the rules. Another backstop is the technical community. I think if it came down to it, the engineers that are still kind of the men and women behind the curtain making Oz happen would say, all right, I guess we got to do something. And those 12 mirror root servers would point to a trusted engineer, the next John Postel, and that person would say, we're going to run it, we're going to do it ourselves, and if you guys don't like it, make your own internet, make your own root server. And they could do it. I mean, they don't want to, I don't think, and it would take a drastic break for them to have to do it, but they could.
I think a lot of those guys are the same guys when I talk about sort of...
Goodbye.
I can't...
Mr. Pascal, how can I help you?
Yes, can you connect me to the mirror room, please?
They don't have a phone in the mirror room.
Yes, there's one in there at the moment we're doing a webcast from, and I need to reconnect to that phone.
Hold on, is there a phone in the mirror room?
Mm-hmm. 662-1216.
Thanks.
Hey.
Hey, we're back up.
Great, thanks.
They're going to do it with the engineers behind them. They can't just point to the engineers and say, do this. The engineer will say, you know, I do this in my spare time. This is not my day job. You can't tell me what to
and
do.
And as a whole, they're anarchists.
Yeah. So,
oh, yeah.
I mean, they're going to want some stability that is more than just the merry band of thieves.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it'll come incrementally, which is exactly what ICANN was meant to represent.
It just seems that apart from other pressures from all over the world, that there's a look, we can't let this happen.
Right.
And will they say, back off, it didn't work the first time, or will they say, okay, come up with a better idea, or whatever it may be?
I do not know. The next IRA, Elliot Maxwell, would be saddled with it. So, all right, well, thank you all for
Thanks
coming.
Thanks for coming a lot.
We'll stick around, if we're allowed to. And we'll follow up by email, and if it turns out you feel it's kind of spam, tell us, we'll take you off the list. And thank you all the speakers, too, for... I don't know. I don't think
right. Well,
hey, anyone there? John? We're done. I'm going to hang up.